United States v. Burnley. Ms. Kister.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel, distinguished guests. I'd like to start this morning, if I may, with the last of the three incidents which I briefed and then work my way backward from there. And I'm starting there because I think of the three, this one may be the one that is most deficient in evidence. If the court recalls, this is the incident where two people enter the bank, Mr. Burnley and Ms. Harding, and by the teller's account, they're wearing fairly odd clothing, she says. Not menacing clothing, not scary-looking clothing, not skull caps or trench coats or ski masks, but just odd clothing.
Wasn't Mr. Burnley's face concealed by a painter's mask?
I don't believe that's clear from the record. The way I read it, Your Honor, he's got a painter's mask that may be hanging down. It may be covering the chin area of his face, but it's not completely concealing his face by any means. And I don't think he's wearing it with that intention in mind. He looks like a painter. He's got on a black outfit and what appears to be a painter's mask. That's the extent of the description of his clothing or his demeanor. All he does is stand in the back of the bank. Ms. Harding approaches the teller, and if the court recalls, she's been described by one witness as 100 pounds soaking wet, and all she does is place a bag on the table and ask, would you do me a favor and put money in here? She doesn't make a demand. She asks almost apologetically and, in fact, goes on and apologizes to the teller.
But she apologizes for making the teller so nervous. I mean, I think part of what we have here is his word, intimidation. And we have to decide what that means, you know, how much of a degree of intimidation. You know, fainting away from, you know, fear is one level, but intimidation when somebody puts a bag on the counter, says, put some money in the bag, I'm sorry I'm making you so nervous, no dye packs. I mean, it's a bank robbery. It's an intimidating situation.
But the statute says that a bank robbery can't just be per se forceful or intimidating, or then any bank robbery. Anytime any teller is approached and asked for money, that per se becomes a robbery.
But did you find any case that illustrated a bank robbery where somebody goes up to the counter and demands the money, even if in polite language, where a court said it wasn't intimidating enough, therefore we find the elements of this crime have not been proven?
No, I did not.
I mean, I was just wondering how much work this word intimidation is doing in the statute.
Well, on the facts here, it's not even clear to me, at least, that this teller was intimidated.
Well, but Harding actually said to her that there was no dye pack in the bag. Right?
And she asked,
and she confirmed that. So clearly she knew it was a robbery, and that was in response to the nervousness. So those were her words.
My recollection of the facts, Your Honor, is that Ms. Harding, after the money is placed in the zippered pouch or the purse, says, and there's no dye pack in here, is there? So it's not beforehand as a means of a veiled threat, you better not put any dye pack in there. She asks her after the fact to confirm that there's no dye pack in there. And, my concern is that any time a teller is the victim of a robbery, there's going to be fear. There's that split second when it's happening or even before it's happening, when you just have a hunch that it's going to happen, you're obviously going to be fearful, panicking. Anybody would be. But I don't think that's enough. I think there has to be an act on the part of the defendant to put that person in fear. It's not a subjective standard. She may have, in fact, been intimidated here. Again, I don't know that we know that. I think Ms. Harding may be herself feeling nervous, and I think she probably was, and she may have said that just from her own nerves.
But Ms. Kister, what is it about this situation that would have made it objectively unreasonable for the teller to feel intimidated? I mean, I just kind of want to turn it around a little bit. We have some subjective notion that she was, because Harding says, I'm sorry I'm making you so nervous. So Harding seems to perceive nervousness. Wouldn't an ordinary person, an objective person, feel intimidated in those circumstances?
Well, if that's the case, then any teller would feel intimidated in any circumstance where someone comes in and asks for money.
Well, you know, one of the things you complain about, like you said, is you think there should have been more evidence about how the tellers reacted, right?
Yes.
Okay, but from the very beginning, didn't trial counsel say that he was conceding that the robberies had been committed? I mean, that's happened in opening statement, that was a statement, and in closing argument. He conceded that a robbery had occurred. And so, you know, why did the government need to put in more when that fact wasn't contested?
And I agree with you that that's a problem from my standpoint, arguing this on appeal. I think the way it was tried, everybody had tunnel vision on. It was tried with an eye towards proving or disproving identity.
Right.
And obviously there was not even an objection or a motion for acquittal at the end of the case on the evidence on this element. So there were simply blinders on. No one was paying attention to it, but I still think it wasn't proven.
Well, don't you think it's a little unfair then to hold the government to complain about no additional testimony when there was that concession terms of what's in the record?
I don't think a concession in an opening statement to a jury amounts to a stipulation that a particular element has already been proven and we're not going to bother proving it here.
But it was also took the same position in closing argument, right?
Yes. But again, I think that's not stipulating to
the
sufficiency.
What do you think is the difference between concession and stipulation?
I think a stipulation, Your Honor, is a legal agreement entered into between the parties, and it's
But of course, if someone concedes something and then the other side tries to prove it, the person who conceded is likely to object. Said, I conceded the point. Why are you harping on it?
And again, I think it was just an...
All the time. You know, when you use a prior crime to impeach a witness, you're not allowed to harp on it. So if the lawyer decides, I don't want to argue over whether it's a robbery, I don't want the jury thinking about robbery, I just want them to think about identity, it's a disservice to the defendant, at least in the defendant's lawyer's conception of the case, for the government to say, well, we're going to prove this really was a robbery. This was intimidation.
And I'll grant you that there's a fairness element involved in that, Your Honor. But I think in point of fact, what was going on was it was a term of art by the defense attorney in simply framing the case to the jury from his own standpoint. I don't think that lets the government off the hook on its burden of proof with respect to an element. And I think in each of these three instances, the element of intimidation and force just simply wasn't there.
Okay. Well, thank you, Ms. Kister. Mr. Yarosh?
Thank you. May it please the court, distinguished guest. Peter Yarosh for the United States. This case and the question of intimidation really revolves around the demand for money that was emphatic, unequivocal, and clear. But what is brought up about the Dye Pact makes it even more telling, because what happens with the Dye Pact is that indicates to the tellers not only that a robbery is occurring, but there's a certain degree of sophistication that's with the robber, if you will.
So you wouldn't parse the robbery the way counsel did and say, you know, well, we have a situation that, you know, the money's given over, and so this issue of the Dye Pact didn't come up until after the money was...
No, and I think if you're talking about specifically the third instance, you have to also take in consideration against the totality of the circumstances, which is what is occurring here. You have two people walk into the bank, one wearing a mask either partially or covering his face. It's unclear from the record, but because this is a question of manifest injustice and all reasonable inferences would be given to the government, they come into the bank, they're odd-looking, and then the person comes up and makes an unequivocal demand for money.
Could I ask you, though, two things, though, Mr. Yarosh. First of all, It does seem to me that the government's position is that the extra word intimidation doesn't really do any work in the statute. It seems to me common sense would say it's an inherently intimidating situation, but then it's all bank robberies equal intimidation. That's my first point. Secondly, though, is it the government's position that this issue is, in fact, properly here? You're not arguing waiver, you're not arguing forfeiture, you're not arguing anything else?
Well, we did argue waiver and that the standard is the manifest injustice. So we're not saying...
plain error. Waiver would mean it's just off the table. Forfeiture would mean that we're allowed to review under plain error standards, manifest injustice, et cetera, et cetera. It was an error, it was plain. I just need to know because it's possible for you to waive the waiver, if you will.
I would not waive the waiver argument, Your Honor. And to go to your other point, which is whether or not the intimidation element carries any weight, it does, and it would be those situations where there was not an unequivocal, emphatic demand for the money. In other words, the Clark decision said that can rise to it under the circumstances.
Badly drafted statute. I mean, robbery means taking money by a threat of force. That's all you need. I mean, you have to have some notion that there's force in the background.
And what this court and the other courts have said, Your Honor, isn't it true that when the demand is made, there's an implied threat that
it's
not complied
with? I mean, suppose you went up to the teller and say, I'm a poor person, and I'd really like you to give me some of your money, but don't give me a dime pack. That won't do me any good, right? I won't be able to spend the dime. So what would that be? Would that be a crime?
Well, I think the way that Your Honor has phrased that particular hypothetical, I think that is not an emphatic demand. I think that's somewhat that's equivocal.
I think it's clearly begging, right? That's not bank robbery.
Well, it's not a demand. It's not emphatic.
Gives a few hundred dollars to that person, you would say the government wouldn't prosecute it as a bank robbery?
Prosecute the teller.
Well, see, that's what I was wondering, actually, whether the only cases you think don't belong under 2113A are, in a sense, collusive cases, where the teller is either a friend of the person who's asking for the money, so there's certainly no intimidation there. The teller's more than happy to give the money over, or the teller is engaging in an act of charity with somebody else's money, namely the banks. Those are cases where you might not see intimidation. But yet the bank is still robbed in the final analysis.
And I think in one of the problems that we were having, in fact, we discussed it at the office, bouncing it around what could be those situations, because obviously in anticipation of the oral argument here. And it was truly difficult to come up with a scenario in which intimidation was not going to occur in a typical sort of bank robbery. The important thing, I think, for this particular case is that the factors are here for intimidation, that under the totality of the circumstances, it is, in fact, an intimidating situation for the tellers and for what occurred here. The idea...
It is a latent threat of force, because there has to be something to back up the demand. You can't go up to the teller and say, you know, I'd really like you to give me money, but if you don't, I'll leave quietly. And what would that be?
Well, right. And I think in the Gilmore decision on the Sixth Circuit, the court made the point of saying that tellers are not in a position to evaluate all the risks that they don't know about. They don't know if the other individual that walked in with this person has a gun. They don't know what role that person has. And it would be putting an onerous burden, on the teller to start making that sort of evaluation. So although I think it becomes a difficult situation, I think under Clark and the facts in this particular case, the defendant did intimidate the tellers and did intimidate sufficient for the purposes of the statute.
And is it clear that the teller knew that Harding was by the door?
Yes, the teller remarked that they saw two people.
I mean that Burnley was by the
door.
One with the painter's mask.
I'm sorry, you're correct, Your Honor. Burnley, they saw two people come into the door. Burnley stood by the forms area, dressed in the on manner that was described, and Harding came towards the teller and made the demand at that point. And that was the last count, count four.
Thank you, Mr. Yash. Ms. Kister, how much time does she have? 2 minutes?
I'll be very brief. I would take issue with the characterization with respect to that third incident, that the demand in that case was unequivocal. I don't think there was a demand at all. I think it's easily characterized as a request on the part of Ms. Harding for money. And the only thing that elevates that particular incident above and beyond an obsequious, apologetic request for money by this tiny woman is the fact that there's a guy standing in the back, and that's all he's doing. In the second incident, there's more of a demand. The speech is couched more in a demand by Ms. Harding. Put some money in this bag and don't put a dye pack in there, but that's it. There's no one else in the bank with her. She's very small, and there is nothing to back up that veiled threat, if you will. If you assume from this language of don't put a dye pack in there that there's a threat implicit, what's she doing to convey to that teller that she's going to carry it out if there is a dye pack placed there? She's got no gun. She's not menacing in and of it herself. She seems to have no bodily or physical ability to back up.
She doesn't know whether she has a gun or not.
But there's
just saying she didn't brandish it.
There's no evidence that she's wearing clothing or any that there would be any ability to conceal a weapon on her.
Okay, well, thank you, Ms. Kister. You were